You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur with another episode of Innovation for Alpha, and I am really excited today to spend some time with Dr. Rick Lehman, who is based in St. Louis, a really well-known sports physician, is involved in a lot of cool projects. We're going to talk about some of those today. So, Dr. Lehman, welcome to the show. Appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate it.
It's going to be great. Let's just talk a little bit kind of generically about your background. Talk a little bit about your training, where you came from prior to getting to St. Louis.
Yeah, kind of an interesting story. I grew up in Miami, and my whole life I always thought I was going to be a professional tennis player, and went to University of Minnesota undergraduate, played tennis, and then left a little early and played some pro tennis. And then the harsh reality that I wasn't any good hit in, and I said, you know, I got to go back to school. And since no one in my family really had any degrees, I didn't know what to do. So I ended up applying to medical school, figuring, you know, if I'm going to go back to school, let me try to hit the home run. And I got into medical school, went to University of Miami, and then I did the rest of my training at Washington University and the University of Pennsylvania. So I did my orthopedics in St. Louis and then a year of sports medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia. And I've been in practice kind of bi-coastal, but St. Louis, L.A. for, you know, 38 years.
Hmm. Was it your athletic background that kind of attracted you to orthopedics in particular, or what's it pulled you in that direction?
That's exactly what happened. What happened was, you know, I didn't know anything about medicine and I couldn't really relate to anything in medicine. I was so much different than everybody. I had long hair and just thought I was all that. And, you know, and then, so here I am in med school, just, wow, this isn't for me. And then when I finished, I was looking for residencies. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I ended up spending 6 weeks in Houston with a bunch of crazy orthopedic guys. They were just nuts, you know, drinking after clinic and carrying on and flight helicopters for the trauma. And I said, these guys are like me, you know, they're not really doctors. So I ended up getting into that. And then when I got into orthopedics, I realized the thing I really understood was sports, right? I lived it. I played the big tournaments, you know, I lost at all the big tournaments. And I realized I really can relate to these guys. I mean, this is what I know. So I've been very, very fortunate and have had probably the luckiest storied career treating pro athletes of anybody. And it's just the one thing I really did understand.
Before we keep going on your trajectory there, I'm curious on tennis. So what's your thoughts on pickleball now that pickleball has gotten to be such a popular sport? Is it interesting to you? Do you find like it's fake tennis, or what do you think?
You know, it's interesting when you talk to the hardcore tennis players, they hate it. They're like, oh, this isn't tennis. But I think as you get a little bit older and grinding, you know, on a tennis court isn't as attractive as it was when you were 25 or 30. Yeah. I think pickleball is a great sport. Number one, anybody can play it. You can have no athletic ability at all and enjoy it, get a little exercise. And number two, and more importantly, it's a lot easier on your body. So I still play tennis with my I have two daughters, both played in college, were great tennis players. And I hit some balls, but clearly for fun, to go out with my wife and my kids or to go out with some friends, pickleball is just now pickleball is now becoming almost a pro sport, right? I mean, yeah. Now people aren't kidding anymore. So it's gotten a little more serious, but I do think it's very, very good. And for people that don't really play racket sports, anybody can play.
I asked you that because my daughter is also a tennis player. She's in high school and I've been trying to convince her she should be really getting into pickleball because it's up and coming. And I was showing her how Andre Agassi and some of the iconic guys are getting into this. And so if it's good enough for them, you know, and so she still thinks, no, it's not cool. And it's for old people. But you know, we'll get into Santa Monica here in a minute because you've got an event coming up there. But I was mentioning to you, I lived in Santa Monica. And I remember back then out on Venice Beach, there's a whole series of pickleball courts. And so this is 20 some years ago. There was a whole professional league of pickleball players before this was known anywhere. And those guys were serious athletes. I mean, it was a serious game. And it was funny because I hadn't thought about it at all in years. And then all of a sudden now, you know, every country club in the country is converting their tennis courts. And so anyway, so you trained at WashU. You were from Miami. How did you end up back in St. Louis to practice? What pulled you back?
Well, so what happened was, you know, I was at University of Pennsylvania. I completed my sports medicine fellowship, and I actually got an offer to job at the University of Pennsylvania. And when I was there, one of my key things was to take care of the Philadelphia Flyer hockey team, which I made a lot of friends at the time, like Keenan, their GM, just all kinds of good friends. So I really got kind of indoctrinated in hockey, and I was going to stay. And you know, the proverbial, I got an offer made that I couldn't turn down. So I got a great offer back in St. Louis. So I came back here, and my wife, who's a plastic surgeon, Dr. Michelle Koo, basically said, she's from California. She said, oh, we're not going to stay in St. Louis. So I said, that's fine. You know, we'll be here a little bit. And as soon as, you know, you're ready to move, we'll move. And, you know, practice got started. Her practice got started, had kids. And the next thing you know, we've always been back and forth some, but now we're back and forth a lot, but because of the Olympic kids, but certainly St. Louis is where the practice is, where we do the surgeries. And it's been fine. I mean, it's in the middle of the country. It's easy for the athletes to get here. So we see them from Florida and California, New York.
Yep.
And, the agents love it here because there's no way to get in any trouble. You know, if you're on South Beach, you're going to get into trouble. You're not getting any. What are you going to do? Look at the arch, right? I mean, how much trouble can you get into?
That's a good point. I say the same thing about Denver. People don't realize when you're in the middle kind of the country like this, getting east and west is so much easier. And you mentioned hockey. You've done a lot of work in hockey. Was that kind of what pulled you in there when you were at in Pennsylvania? And then you've been in the sport in one form or another ever since, haven't you?
Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. You know, I got kind of, I was from Miami, so I don't know anything about hockey and got indoctrinated at Penn, and no one wanted to cover the hockey games. You know, this is 1986, and it's like, you know, this idiot wants to go to all these hockey games, let him cover the game. So I became really good friends with the staff and really good friends with, like I said, Mike Keenan and the GM and all the people. So when I got back into St. Louis, you know, I promptly got a job as a team doctor for the St. Louis Blues hockey team, which was great. And then I got offered a position in Tampa, you know, just to be honest, to be transparent, for more money. So I said, well, I'll just be the team doctor in Tampa. So I was flying down to Tampa and I was their team doctor. And then I get a call from the Florida Panthers and they said, you know, we'll pay you whatever you want. We need, because we had an unbelievable track record of missed man games and just managing injuries. And if you're an athlete, you really kind of figure out how this all works. And I think we did a good job. And I said, well, I'll join the medical team, but I'm only going to join the medical team if you let me buy into the team. I want to be a limited partner. So I bought in with the team, and these guys are still really good friends. And we owned the Panthers for 10, 12 years and then sold. And, you know, doing the medical was great. And I was an alternate governor on the board of governors for the NHL. I mean, I really had a great time. We weren't any good, but I had a great time. and early in my career in St. Louis, I took care of a guy you never heard of named Ivory Crockett. Ivory Crockett was a sprinter and actually a famous sprinter. He held the world's record in 100-yard dash and he broke the record in the 100-yard dash. And then they switched the race to the 100-meter dash, so he'll have the record forever because it's the same race. And he introduced me to Jackie Joyner-Kersee before the World Championships because she had an ankle injury. And I guess, you know, they say the rest is history. Well, her husband is a guy named Bob Kersee. He was a head track coach at UCLA. And after we kind of got into this a little bit, we started training pro athletes. You know, athletes said, well, if I'm a football player, I want to run fast. I want to go to the guy who makes me run the fastest and makes all these other people run the fastest. So we trained, you know, Jerome Bettis, Ty Law, just tons of great athletes and took care of them, did their surgeries and rehabbed them. And then one of the caveats was a guy named Grant Fuhrer, who was a goalie, tore his ACL. I took care of his ACL. And I said to management, I said, you know, if you really want this guy back, you need to hire this guy, Bobby Kersey. He's the real deal. And so Bobby took some time off, came, worked with us at the Blues, and he was just, you know, he was crazy. And strength and conditioning guys were just killing it. And, you know, he was just making it fun because he's just out of his mind. And it was great. So from there, we just become great friends. We've trained unbelievable, great athletes, besides track and field athletes. And now, like I said, now we have a story program. The kids we have now in the next Olympics in Paris are just going to be, people are just going to be astounded. I mean, we got a ton of talent and they've just been doing very well.
That's cool. And you've got a program coming up with Bob out in Santa Monica, right?
Yes, sir. So actually in 2 days, Thursday night, Bobby, myself, and a guy named Bob Forcer, who's a physical therapist, called the Team Behind the Gold. And, you know, not to brag, because I don't really think it's me, I think it's Bobby, we've had unbelievable success. And you know, if you run track, you're going to get hurt. Just like if you play in the NFL, there's no way to play in the NFL or NHL or run at a high level, not get hurt. So that's just part of the deal. And I think the more injuries you see and the better you treat them and the kind of stay ahead of the game, you know, like I tell the agents, I said, look, your doctor's an iPhone 5, we're an iPhone 20. I mean, we're just so ahead of the curve because we've seen so much. Not that that's we're cool. better. You can't do something for 30 years. And I mean, if you can't figure it out in 30 years, you need to do something else. So, you know, it's been great. And we've had great success. And, you know, I guess we're going to tell our story a little bit, but our story is not really going to get told until after. I think when people see what's going to happen in Paris, people are just going to shake their heads and say, you know, these guys are for real.
How much of that, you know, when you talk about the experience and the wisdom that gets built up over those years, how much of that, you know, as a surgeon is anticipating what could go wrong and helping these guys prevent that versus, you know, taking care of it after the fact, you know, sort of treatment.
$1 million question. And so when I was with the Blues, you know, I thought of it kind of again as an athlete. And I said, look, if you've had a bad knee or you had a bad hamstring, you know, what's going to break? The thing that's going to break is the thing that broke before. So if we can look at so-and-so with a bad back and say, this is the problem with their back, even though their back is fine, that's going to be the weak link in the system. So when I look at athletes, I say to myself, you know, and I ask them, you know, what's your problem been? And so when we go through their biomechanical analysis, which is very analytical and very high tech, we're really looking for the weak link in the system. And I think preventing the injury is a lot easier than treating the injury. And I can't tell you how many times a week or 2 weeks before the World Championships or the Olympics, someone pulls a hamstring or pulls an Achilles, you know, and you're out of luck. So if you can prevent that whole process, obviously, you know, you're the smartest guy in the room. And I think that's been a big benefit for us.
How much of that now, you know, when an athlete has one of those injuries, do you think this could have prevented if we did A, B, or C, or it's just the way it is, things are going to break, that's life? I mean, how much of that, looking backwards, would you think is preventable?
You know, I think, you kind of hit on the head, they're parallel worlds. So you're driving towards a basket, playing in the NBA, you step on someone's foot, you tear your ACL. Well, that, you know, you're in a car accident, whatever.
Yeah,
you
know, that's just going to happen.
Something, a brick falls on your head, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So those injuries, they're going to happen. And I would say that's probably 20% to 25% of what happens. And I think 75% is muscle imbalance, is understanding the biomechanics. I saw a kid today who's going to be an Olympic sprinter. She's unbelievable talent. And, you know, she hurt her hamstring in January. So 2-3 months ago, and they're rubbing Epsom salts on it and hoping it gets better. Well, hope's not the best treatment plan we can come up with. So I think understanding. So after I examined her, I said, look, you're going to pull your hamstring the rest of your life if you don't fix these four things. So she probably will never pull again because we're going to fix the biomechanics. So I think you're told me you're 100% on point in that. If you look at the biomechanics of what's wrong, and no different than a pitcher, no different than a quarterback, a swimmer, then you can prevent those problems. And then again, 25%, you know, or just bad luck, wrong place, wrong time, You know, Joe Theismann breaks his tibia. All the mechanics in the world weren't going to help that.
You know, there's another side of that discussion I'm curious about. So when you mentioned, you know, a young athlete. So how much have you gotten to the point where, whether it's a track and field athlete or some other sport, where you can identify, let's say at 10, 11, 12, 14, whatever, is there a period where you can start to say, you know what, this kid's got something special. They are, you know, D1 caliber or even pro caliber. What's too early to make that determination, would you say?
You know, it's an interesting question. And when I give my talks, I always talk about it. And I say that when these athletes walk in the office, they're different than everybody else. Like they're not, they don't look like, you know, so, and you know, dad will come in and he'll say, well, my son ran for 320 yards. He runs a 5.140 and he's got a 14 inch vertical and he's going to go play in Nebraska. And the next kid comes in and, you know, he's got a 41 inch vertical. He ran a 4.15 40. And I think to myself, no matter how hard this other kid tries, he's never going to be able to run a 4.240. He runs a 5.140. He might run a 5.040, 4.940, but he ain't playing in D1 college and he's not playing and he might play D3 somewhere. So the answer to your question is I would say at about 12 or 13, I could look at a kid and I could tell you pretty much the rest of the story. I can't tell you if they're going to get hurt, but I can tell you,
yeah,
this kid, you know, he has got it. And, or this kid doesn't have it. And, you know, athletes are born. You can get better, but you can't take Rick Lehman and get him to run a 10 flat 100. That's not going to happen. No matter how hard I train, no matter how bad I want it. And so, and it's the same thing with hitting a baseball. You know, I could work as hard as I want, but if someone throws me a 90 mile per hour fastball that I can't see, I can't hit it.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is these kids are born, and you can tell if you're doing this day in and day out, this kid's got it. And this other kid, he should go learn to play the violin because he done got it.
You know, to that end. So you mentioned kind of 12, 13, 14 in that range. Is it because of puberty? Like once you see puberty hitting, then you really start to see, or can you identify some things even pre-puberty in terms of a kid being special in whatever sport that is?
Well, you know, when you look, I had a kid in today and you could just tell, I mean, he's probably young, but it's body mechanics, it's balance. And, you know, I can't tell, a lot of times I can't tell in the room when I'm examining him, but I'll say, hey, you know, send me a little photo of, you know, John pitching or John hitting or whatever. And you can just tell body mechanics, balance, biomechanics. And really, you can tell pre-puberty a little bit, but once they go through puberty, like a gymnast, you know, a gymnast is a completely different kid pre-puberty than post-puberty, because if all of a sudden they have a 9-inch growth spurt, twirling through the air is not so easy. So I think that most of these kids really, you tell when they hit that 12, 13-year-old mark, 14-year-old at the latest. I think the kids that at 10 or 11 that have unbelievable body position stability and coordination probably are good bets. You know, so they're in the 60-70%. And then once they hit puberty, you can tell pretty much 100%. And I think that the easier thing to tell is the kids that can't do it. You know, it's picking Serena Williams out is hard. There's only one Serena Williams. Yeah. But picking the other 10,000 kids that can't do it is a little easier. So when I see, you know, now we see top athlete after top athlete, so maybe we're spoiled. But when I see kids and I see that they're working so hard and they're training and you know, they're just unable to really crack whatever that sport is, basketball, baseball, you know, I realize that it's a struggle for them, where when you watch somebody who's got it, you know, they see that ball at 95 miles per hour. It looks like a beach ball to them. To me, I don't see it.
Yeah.
And so that's a skill you can't teach anybody.
That's really interesting. So kind of along these lines, you wrote a book, I think it was during COVID, if I'm not mistaken, but How to Raise an Athlete, Formula for you know, this kind of talk a little bit about what you cover in the book.
Yeah. You know, someone came to me and they said, hey, you've been doing this a long time. And, you know, you should tell parents how to do this right. And I said, well, you know, I was a parent of three pretty good athletes and I did everything wrong. So I know exactly how to do it right, because I didn't do it right. And that's the truth. I mean, I was terrible, terrible parent or athletic parent. So I kind of put together, you know, we talked to a ton of people, pro athletes, coaches, everybody, and we put together, you know, basically a manual of how to do it. You know, you're a parent, because no one tells you how to do it.
Yeah.
It just makes people say, well, there's no book on how to parent. Well, there's really no book on how to raise your kid. If you want to get the most out of his athletic ability, him or her not to hate you at the end of the ride and maximize their athletic ability. And the book really it's just a how to walk you through, you know, what to do, what not to do, how to surround yourself, how to talk to your child. And it's not very long. It's something you should stick in your pocket and reference every once in a while. But it's really, you know, make a right turn, make a left turn. There's a 7-Eleven. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And we've had unbelievable success with the book, because I think anyone can read it. Coaches can read it. ADs can read it. And it just really tells you the pitfalls. And some of the stuff's so logical, but when I read the book after I wrote the book in the edits, I'm like, God, why didn't I do this? I should have read this book before. I mean, this is so ridiculous. So it's common sense, but a lot of it is, you know, it wakes you up and, you know, it tells you as a parent what not to do, which is probably more important again than what you should do.
Sure. You know, as I remember years ago, it was about 3 years ago, I was talking to Jimmy Andrews and I'd asked him, are there any trends in youth sports that you know, he says, that's easy. The biggest trend is kids who are specializing and it's leading to injury. So these kids are training over and over all year round. Your body's not designed for that. And I remember he gave me the example of Jordan Spieth, and he said, Jordan's parents didn't let him play golf year round. They forced him to play basketball. Turns out he was pretty good in basketball, but it forced him to take time off, work different muscles. And I remember he said, Jordan will play golf the rest of his life. His body won't break down because of that that differentiation.
I think Jimmy's right.
He's got a little experience as well. Like the two of you, you've seen a few athletes. I want to talk just a little bit, change directions just a little bit. You've done a lot of work with articular cartilage and I think you've worked with Biomed, if I'm not mistaken, and did some work there. Talk a little bit about that, because it's particularly for adults, people who have osteoarthritis and all kinds of different things. Basically, what it amounts to is pain. But what's your expertise, or what's your, you know, just kind of some of the things you've done in that area?
Well, you know, I think if you look at if you do what I do and you see athletes, and you can pick them anywhere out on kind of the timeline. You know, what are they going to hurt? I mean, they may tear their ACL, but you take a kid, he's 6'6", 325, he's an offensive lineman, and he has knee pain. 9 times out of 10, he's got an articular cartilage lesion. Now, you take a 55-year-old guy who's run his whole life or played basketball his whole life or tennis or pickleball his whole life, what is he going to have? He's going to have arthritis, going to have an articular cartilage lesion.
Yeah.
And we're not really very good at this. We're getting better, but we're not very good at it, to be honest. So in working with Biomet, we put together a program trying to reconstruct or recreate articular cartilage using a biphasic graft. So we're going to put in cadaver cartilage and bone and make a biphasic graft and basically plug the holes where the cartilage was missing. Hmm. And this is if you use your own cartilage, it's called OATS. If you use somebody else's cartilage, a cadaver cartilage, bovine cartilage, whatever. It's called an autograft and allograft. And that cartilage can regenerate and make cartilage. And so what's the biggest problem? The biggest problem is people get a little arthritis, it progresses, they get a total knee and on with the show. And that's fine when you're 55, 60 years old. But if you're a 27-year-old NBA player who's had 4 knee surgeries, that's not fine. Mm. And a lot of guys have ended their career with articular cartilage lesion injuries. And you can go down the list. First-round draft picks who never played, lots of examples. And so we put together a program really looking to fix this golden grail or holy grail, make it the golden grail of trying to fix articular cartilage. And we've been successful. And I think the technology is going to continue to progress where, you know, pretty soon, instead of having a total knee, they're going to put in a little chia thing and it's going to grow cartilage and you're not going to need metal and plastic. So that these reconstructions will be biologic. But this is where the research is going and will continue to go.
What's your sense of, you know, where that is? And I asked that question with this context. I had a friend, orthopedic surgeon, probably 5 years ago, said to me, you know, technology is advancing so quickly. He said, I tell people, if you can hold off on, you know, the total whatever, 5 years from now, it'll be amazing. You'll never have to get it redone. And so I've always had that in mind, like the longer you can wait, the better this tech is getting. So, I mean, are we on the cusp of certain big breakthroughs as your sense, or is it just iterative where it's going to get a little better every year? Where are we at with this for the person who's really not familiar?
No, I think that's a good question. You know, I think much like technology, which is just crazy, right? Every year you're like, oh, wow. That's where biomedical research is. And really, maybe not so much in America, but Japan is kind of ahead of the curve and the Koreans are kind of ahead of the curve. So I think we're on the breakthrough of not having total joints. I think we're going to figure out a way to biologically create cartilage and maybe put some substrate in and grow cartilage on top of that substrate. So my take is much like your buddies. And I think that, yes, every year it gets a little better, but I think I know these people doing the research. I've seen the research and I know that if it continues to get funded, the problem with this whole process is the insurance company, not to be negative. And, you know, are they going to pay for this technology? And that's really going to be the issue in the States. But in Japan and Korea and some of these countries, they're way ahead of us because they know that they're going to get funded and they get funded. So I think we are on the verge of a substantial change in the trajectory of arthroplasties.
I want to go backwards just a little bit to youth. You've got a book in the works this year, kind of a little different, talking about childhood obesity. Talk a little bit about the book and the research into that, because it's a huge problem.
Well, you know, I think if you were to pick one, you know, if you say, hey, what's the biggest problem in the world right now? You'd have to say it's obesity. So, you know, what's the quickest way to have diminishment in your life? You know, what's costing this country the most in medical expenses? Type 2 diabetes, osteoarthritis. So if you would look at one thing, which no one wants to talk about, it's obesity. And where does obesity start? I mean, it can start anywhere, but really, in most cases, it starts in youth. So it's rare to see somebody who's skinny as an adult, and they were really heavy at 13 or 14 years old. It's rare. So when we, and it's not an American problem either. I mean, it's an international problem, and the problem progresses as we get more processed foods, more fast foods. And look, no one loves a McDonald's hamburger like myself, so I get it. and I think that it's so socially hands-off, right? I mean, you can't fat shame, you can't say anything. So it's really taken a back seat. And I think fat shaming is terrible. And when people say, oh, you know, it's bad to talk about obesity, my comment is I'm not really talking about obesity. I'm talking about health. Yeah. I don't care if you're 900 pounds, if you're healthy.
Yeah.
But if you're going to get type 2 diabetes and early osteoarthritis and you're going to die 10 years younger and you're not going to see your daughter walk down the aisle and get married or go to their graduation, then, you know, we have a problem. And that's what's happening. So having seen it for so many years and not really having had the bandwidth or the time or the resources to study it, you know, I just have a lot of notes and a lot of research and a lot of patience, but haven't really gotten into the why. And probably about a year ago, I just said, this is just too big a deal. And, you know, when you're a sports guy, everybody's fit. So, so that world, it isn't really a problem. And the only obese people that I really see are athletes that have played and then gained, you know, maybe lost a little weight when they quit and then just quit working out and got big. Well, they quit working out because they had knee pain and they had this or they had that. So it is a big problem. And I think the youth of our country has, you know, I have to tell you the statistic, has the propensity to get bigger every year. The numbers of childhood obesity go up every year. And so we need, as a country and as a world, to figure this problem out, or everyone's going to have type 2 diabetes. So we're in the middle of writing the book. We've got a lot of research. We're using significant researchers. So people who studied it, not from a social aspect, but from a true research, biomechanical, medical aspect. And I think the book is going to be really great. I mean, it's going to be something no one wants to read. Everyone should read. But I think it's really going to bind all the data and give us some true answers as to how to address this problem head on. And I think we need to do it, because at some point it's just going to be not cost effective to have such a high percentage of people with a BMI over 35.
Yeah, that's great. We'll have to cover the book when it comes out. We'll put a link, by the way, to the current book in the show notes. But you know, you kind of alluded to earlier in our conversation, I mean, there's a number of things that are, you know, sort of clearly right in front of us. Food with, you know, high glycemic index to it, and kids, you know, popping chips all day long. But then there's also the video game sedentary lifestyle. Instead of kids being out on the playground hitting the ball, they're blowing friends up in Fortnite, you know, for hours on end. What could go wrong with that equation? I want to wrap it up there. We're going to do a feature in MD Next magazine where we cover a number of additional topics with Dr. Lehman, and we've got more we'll cover over time. But Dr. Lehman, thanks so much for being on the show. Love to hear your perspectives on all this. Really fun stuff, and love the things you're working on. Really exciting.
Well, no, you're a great host, and I really appreciate it. And you know, we'll have to do it again.
Thank you. All right. So I will cut it there. Let me just rifle off a series of questions. And like I said, we'll turn these into a draft. I'll send you the draft and maybe we can add to it. And then at some point, if you've got some high-res photos, and could be anything, could be track and field, could be hockey, any number of things, it'd be fun to load those up. By the way, I have to ask you, last time we talked, you had just gotten back, if I recall, from, was it Brazil? Somewhere in South America where you were involved. Was it, what was the work of the company again? Is it in the oil space, olive oil, or?
So this guy, this is Tito, his deal is they have the biggest, they're the biggest producer of ethanol from corn. So they take corn and they make ethanol. And I think they also use some of the, I mean, I don't really understand it that well, but some of the corn I think is actually made into high fructose corn syrup.
Sure.
But I think the majority of the corn that you can use, because I think there's two parts of the corn, goes into making ethanol. And these guys, you know, they have this is not like a bunch of Brazilians out there with hats and machetes. This looks like Star Wars. I mean,
I'm sure
this is a crazy, you know, this operation looks like, you know, Microsoft. And so, so we spent, I think we went to a wedding, we spent a week there, and, I'm getting involved financially and helping them. But you know, this process, and I'm sure we do it here. This process, I think, you know, and I don't know, but I don't see the longevity of this. And I told him that. I said, you know, in America, by 2035, all the cars, I think, are going to be, or the majority of cars are going to be electric.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's going to happen to all your ethanol. And they said, we'll just revert to making, you know, corn products, high fructose corn syrup, et cetera. And, we're going to make fuel for industry, not for automobiles. So they see this coming, but what an amazing, and the lifestyle this guy lives. I mean, obviously I don't know what he's worth, a few billion dollars. So he has a home right on the beach and they have 40 workers at the house. I mean, 40 workers, And you know, it was ridiculous.
That's another level.
It's another level. Even you know, even if you know a lot of billionaires, I mean, these guys are, you know, they're just. And I asked him, the son's name is Henry, and Henry and I operate on Henry. Henry and I are tight. And I said, you know, how can you afford to have so many people? You know, I mean, even in the States, I mean, you have to pay them whatever, $20 an hour. I mean, right. You have 40 of them, they're here 24/7. He goes, oh, you don't pay, you know, give them room and board and food, and you don't pay them hardly. So, I mean, it's a different dynamic.
Yeah. By the way, along those lines, kind of a different deal, but so a good friend of mine in Seattle, he's a real character. He's probably the smartest guy I've ever met. He's a computer scientist. He's built and sold 13 companies. He sold one to Paul Allen. He sold one to Bill Gates, two to Jeff Bezos at Amazon. He's made a fortune, and he has this crazy house. It's in the middle of town, essentially.
In Seattle.
What's that?
In Seattle.
In Seattle. Yeah. It's a 17-acre farm in the middle of town. Ranch, really. He has a full staff of stonemasons, electricians. He's got a drawbridge to get into the house. He's got a moat around the whole place, a hand-built stone, you know, fence around the 17 acres. But he has, he's really a genius. He just thinks about these things, and then he tells his staff, I want to build, you know, whatever. But he's got 17 bison, which is the maximum he can have. And he's crossbreeding bison and horses, because he said he wants to create the BMX of animals. He wants a stronger horse, but a faster bison. And you know, he's got it all down. Like, it takes 7 generations. He's filed for the, you know, the genomic name of this new species. He's really a piece of work. But when you say, like, whenever I go to his house, oh, and the other thing he's got is this whole fleet of military vehicles. He flies them in from Europe from, like, the, you know, the 50s, these crazy vehicles. He has them restored, but that's how they travel around the property. And I always ask him, like, how the hell do you afford, like, electricians and stonemasons full time? He's like, I don't really pay them that much money. They just love working here. So anyways, character.
I love it.
Let me give you just a rapid fire series of questions. I kind of alluded to some of them earlier, but let's talk just a little bit about trends. So trends in the orthopedics profession, maybe specifically, it could be broadly healthcare. As you think about the industry right now, are there, you know, it could be new technologies, it could be reimbursement trends, but, you know, what's your sense of the pulse of either the broader industry or the specific orthopedics? Anything come to mind?
So I think the big trend in medicine in general is biologics. I think that's kind of where we're hitting. And you talk about different monoclonal antibodies treating cancers. So it's your body creating healing of your problem. Yep. And in orthopedics, we use umbilical stem cells and something called platelet-rich plasma, PRP, and we use mesenchymal stem cells, and we're basically trying to recreate cartilage cells from little baby cells and maybe islet cells in the pancreas and cure cancers using your monoclonal antibodies. So I think if you said, give me what's going to happen, I think it's all good. We already know how to fix the ACL. We kind of know how to fix the elbow and the Tommy John, but we're probably in the first or second inning of understanding how to turn your body into healing your body. Mm. And I think if you said, where's the trend going? That's where the trend's going.
That's cool. I mentioned this question earlier, thinking back maybe to a young surgeon, kind of just getting out of residency, fellowship, whatever, are things that you've learned over the course of your career that you'd put your arm around them and say, hey, you know, pay attention to this, or go this direction, don't go this direction. Any of that kind of stuff come to mind?
You know, I think there's two things, and it really served me well. One thing was, you know, do something that you really love to do. You know, sports was something I really understood. I really loved to do, and I could do it well. So I think that's one thing. And I think the harder thing is try to forget the economics, because, and that's an easy thing to say and a hard thing to do. But I think if you go, you know, if you go into medicine and you do it the right way and you do it for the right reason, you're probably not going to make a ton of money, just the way the industry has changed.
Yeah.
But I think if you really love it, you're going to have a very fulfilled life. And there's nothing happier than turn it on your TV and watch some kid you fix their ACL dunk a basketball on you know, during the tournament or during the NBA playoffs. So I just think the reward in my mind for medicine needs to be the process more than financial. And I think if you want to go into finances, you know, don't be, you know, get your MD degree, do your training, and then go into med tech or, you know, fintech or something.
Yeah.
But don't treat patients with the idea that you know, that's how you're going to make your money. Cause I think that gets us off in the wrong direction and gets us into trouble.
That's great. Great advice. And probably ubiquitous across every industry. You know, it's if you love what you do, then you've never worked a day in your life, as they say.
Yeah.
How about AI? You know, this is obviously, AI has been a topic for a number of years, but really has heated up lately. You know, there's a new study that we just posted today in our daily newsletter that talked about categories where they anticipate AI having the most disruption. And invariably in these studies, healthcare is always in the top five. I was interested actually in this particular study. They said the accounting industry is going to be the number one most disruptive industry, because they said 50% of what accountants do can be replaced by AI, which is not great if you're a CPA. But do you see AI yet kind of creeping into your day to day? Is it visible, or what's your sense of that?
You know, so I think AI has two things you can see. First of all, I think most of the decisions that we make as doctors, and I wouldn't say 100%, but the majority of them are pretty routine, pretty AI friendly. Mm. Now there's weird diseases and there's weird things that happen in surgery, and they're outliers, but there's not many. So, you know, you get COVID, it's predict, you know, there's, you have this symptom, that symptom, that symptom, you know, you go to ChatGPT, you get the answer, and it tells you what to do.
Yeah.
So I think medicine is probably going to be significantly affected, especially with the idea that MDs are not treating as many patients. You have more PAs and NPs, physicians, assistants, nurse practitioners.
Yeah.
And I think all that can be pretty much taken over by AI. And I think when you look at surgery, you know, we all know about robotics. And I think a lot of that will be done by AI. I don't know why you would need someone hands-on, except in the very, very low percentage of weird cases. So sometimes you'll see something and, you know, it's something you've read about and it's kind of an outlier. And like I saw a guy today, played NFL football. It's this whole aside, and he's got this thing called geniculate artery arteritis. Well, no machine's going to figure this out. When he swallows, he gets this burning thing, and he you know, just about chokes him to death. No one's going to figure that out. I never even heard of it. But 99% of what you get, you know, kidney stones, you can just torn meniscus. I mean, pretty routine, and I don't see any reason why AI can't do all that.
It's interesting you bring that up. I have a friend who's a cardiac surgeon. He was telling me, it's a couple of years ago. He said, you know, I could literally train you to do most everything I do in 2 weeks. He goes, you could be doing surgeries in 2 weeks. He goes, but they're not paying me to do that stuff. He goes, they're paying me when crap goes wrong, because then in the middle of that, he goes, that's when I step in and I can kind of, you know, manage all the variables and bring things to a good conclusion. He goes, but to your point, he's, you know, I think of the time, he said 90% of what I do, literally a monkey could do. He goes, but it's the other 10% where, it, you know, crap is important. So that was kind of funny. What, when you, I'm just thinking about books, like what, you know, in your spare time, I'm going to get a little bit into like habits and things that you enjoy, but are there books in particular that you've read maybe in the recent memory that stand out that you would recommend, whether to physicians or just in general? It doesn't have to be specific to physicians.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I love to read, and I love reading classics. It's, you know, I think most of the books that I read, All the President's Men. I mean, there's just a number of them, and they're just classics, and they're classics for a reason. So I'm not one of these guys that goes to the bookstore and reads, you know, this most popular book. What I do is I go online, I look at, you know, let's say the last 10 years, 200 most popular books, and I read a lot. So I will read those books, and then I'll read on topics that I have significant interest in. So the biomechanics of motion analysis, et cetera. Mm. And I like understanding that. But I think for people out there, the classics are classics for, and I don't mean, you know, The Great Gatsby. I mean, in the last 5 or 10 years, and there's some amazing books out there that are just crazy. And Orphan Master's Son was a book by a guy named Adam Johnson. I mean, it's just riveting. It's a Pulitzer Prize winning book. So you know, I stick to those kinds of books. And again, they're classics for a reason. Just like if you go on ESPN and they're showing you classic football games, you know, you can bet that game's gonna be pretty good.
That makes sense. You've done work with industry. Maybe for you know, again, younger surgeon who hasn't worked with industry before, are there any things you learned over the years working with some of these, you know, presumably bigger organizations? Just anything you would have changed or recommend to a guy wanting to do some work with industry?
Well, you know, I would tell the surgeons out there, you know, you have a lot to offer. You have an understanding that's different. And I would tell everybody who has that propensity to get involved in industry, you know, something we did 10, 12 years ago. Someone came to me and they said, "Hey, we're going to get a license to sell marijuana." And I was like, "Wow, that's kind of progressive." But we got into the marijuana business, and in Denver, you know, there's more marijuana stores than Starbucks, but
yeah.
So for probably the right reasons, you know, we opened up a dispensary, it got bigger and bigger, and now we've got a whole probably 7 or 8 states cultivation dispensary. And it's really been very interesting because in Europe, if you understand about marijuana, I mean, they treat a lot of diseases, pancreatic cancer, gastric cancer, melanoma. I mean, they're way ahead of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still to the point of we're using it to help you sleep and, you know, maybe for some peripheral neuropathy, but marijuana has a lot of uses in the medical community. And again, it's the best sleep aid you're ever going to get. And I'm not talking about going and getting blitz. I'm just saying you a little bit of combination of THC and some CBD and you'd be surprised. So, I think if that's your passion to get in the industry, do it early, you know, while your ideas are fresh. And I think you have a lot to learn from them and they have a lot to learn from you. But it really enhances your life because there's nothing more fun than giving a talk or being involved in a study. We have a pharmaceutical company that we're looking for. We got a drug and we're doing the research to treat ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. Mm. And, you know, when you're seeing 60 patients a day, 70 patients a day and doing 30 surgeries a week, there's nothing more fun than a whole diversion of saying, all right, now I'm going to, you know, get into this research project or I'm going to give a talk. So I think it rounds out your life, but it also takes, you know, everybody talks about doctor burnout. You need to do some different stuff.
Yeah.
And I think industry is the perfect different stuff to do.
I love it. One last question actually to follow up on that a little bit. So, you know, I'm presuming that at this stage in your career, you've created lots of optionality. You mentioned you're headed out to Santa Monica. You've got your surgical work. You've got some entrepreneurial projects. You've got the books. What is your, you know, I know there's probably no such thing as a typical day, but kind of like a week look like for you that's maybe, you know, probably a little different than when you were 35, just in terms of what's the ebb and flow of your week look like and you know, and what's because you just mentioned that variety is probably makes it a lot makes it really interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's great. I mean, so a typical week would be, you know, let's say you're going to see patients, and now the patient flow is very special because we're seeing high end athletes, you know, household names, and so that makes it fun. I would say on a typical week, I have a radio show Tuesday morning, a radio show Thursday night that I do. I'm going to do a radio show tonight. I'll have probably be on TV once, and I'll probably fly out to somewhere to either give a presentation or take a meeting. I would say at least once every 2 weeks. for a couple days. So I'll be in LA for a couple days. I was at the Yellowstone Club last week giving a presentation. So I just think my typical life has really changed. Now, my, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I saw 70 patients a day, did 25, 30 surgeries a week. I never went anywhere except the hockey games. And, you know, it was nose to the grindstone. And I think that's where you burn out. And if I were going to make a change, I would have started doing some of these ancillary things earlier. And again, not for the money so much, but for the variety.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more fun for me than being on the radio. First of all, I'm terrible, but I don't care. You know, it's just different than seeing patients.
That's cool. What, like, you know, in terms of the radio, like typically what are you on, talking about clinical topics, talking about sports, or is it just all over the map?
Yeah, it's mostly about sports. Sometimes it's about sports medicine. So, you know, if somebody blows out their elbow or, you know, Brock Purdy gets hurt and he has a TJ or whatever, you know, we talk a little bit about that stuff, or there's some horrendous injury everybody's talking about, you know, Willis McGahee-esque injury. We'll talk about that. But a lot of it's just you know, sports, you know, what do you think is going to happen to Jalen Hurts? I mean, just, there's just all kinds of medical and a lot of questions these people call because they've got these fantasy teams. So they're like, oh, when do you think so-and-so will be back? So, you know, I don't know that I have any insight to that, but the radio show, people call in, you know, sometimes, hey, my 15-year-old son tore his ACL. Huh. And, but it's just so much fun because, like I said, it's just so, it's such a diversion. And, you know, it's one of those things. And the other thing for young doctors out there, there's not a better way to get your name out there, right? Sure. I mean, you know, if you're on the radio 2 days a week, 3 days a week, you know, people are going to hear, whether they want to go to you or not, I don't know, but they're going to hear your name.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. Well, this has been great. Thanks a ton for taking time. We'll get this edited up. We'll put the draft for the magazine together and more to follow up. I really, really enjoyed starting to get to know you. Thanks for your time.
No, thank you. You've been great. And, you know, text me, hit me. I mean, you know, I love this kind of stuff. And I think the book will be a big deal. I really do. I think we're going in a good direction. We need to get the word out. I don't know if we'll help anybody, but it's going to be pretty inclusive. So I'll keep you posted. And, you know, I think it'd be good, a good thing for you guys to report on.
Yeah.
Especially as innovative as you guys are.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.